Donald Trump canceled the White House's subscriptions to the New York Times and the Washington Post, and now one local government is following the president's lead.
I don't want the New York Times in this county. I don't agree with it. I don't like them.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for November 7th, we'll look at how national trust in the media is being undermined from the top down. Plus, Latino, Hispanic, Latinx, the ongoing conversation about language and self-identification in the U.S.
I think the use of gendered words having absolutely nothing to do, I think, is a very abstract idea that doesn't really operate in real human life.
Let's hit it. We'll start with trust in the media.
It's all a hoax. It's a scam.
At a campaign rally in Louisiana Wednesday night, President Trump struck a familiar tone when talking about the impeachment inquiry.
And you know who helps them? These people right back here, the media.
But Donald Trump has been railing against the press since before he was elected president.
You are fake news.
Fake news. That was just fake news.
And fake news has since given way to Trump calling the media the
enemy of the people.
Trust in me. Just in me.
Late last month, Trump's war on the press escalated again when the administration announced that copies of the New York Times and the Washington Post would no longer be delivered to the White House. And the White House is now pushing other federal agencies to end their subscriptions, too. It's a tactic that's increasingly trickling down to the local level. Across the country, politicians are echoing his comments about fake news. In Citrus County, Florida, the Board of Commissioners recently invoked Trump's anti-media rhetoric when a local library requested a digital subscription to the New York Times for its patrons. Here's one of the commissioners, Scott Carnahan, speaking at an October meeting.
I agree with President Trump. I will not be voting for this. I don't want the New York Times in this county. I don't agree with it. I don't like them. It's fake news, and I'm voting no.
And it's a sentiment that might be on the rise. A study by Gallup for the Knight Foundation last year found that most adults, including 9 out of 10 Republicans, say they've lost trust in the news media over the years. Joining me now are Kyle Pope, editor and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review, and Zachary Sampson, staff writer for the Tampa Bay Times. Thanks to you both for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, Zachary, you're there on the ground. Tell us about this decision by the Citrus County Board of Commissioners. How did the issue of a New York Times subscription even get to the level that it got to?
Right. So a couple of weeks ago, on October 24th, a small item came across the county commission's meeting, and it was whether or not the local library system should pay $2,700 for a digital subscription for all 70,000 of the county's library card holders to the New York Times. And that, you know, like a lot of things on a county commission meeting agenda, for people who have covered a county commission meeting, seemed like a pretty quick thing, a couple signatures and you'd move on. But the commissioners sort of balked at it and said, no, the New York Times is fake news. We support President Trump. Why would we do this? And at that point, it became about a lot more than a small funding request or a contract or anything to do with something that was happening at the library.
Well, let's be clear. I mean, most of us have been to libraries. We know that when you walk into a library, one of the first things that you can get access to are publications from all over. This just happens to be the digital version of the New York Times. What has been the reaction, Zachary, from the community? Has the community said anything about this?
Yeah, that's a good question. So they're still having, I think, two print copies of the New York Times that are available at libraries there, but this would have opened up access to people with disabilities, people who couldn't get to the library to read it, just by having the digital subscription. So, you know, I think, as is the case with a lot of stories today, for the first week and a half or so, this was something that was playing out just in Citrus. That's a county that's conservative. It's about an hour north of Tampa. And it was, you know, people who were engaged in the county commission, people who were engaged in the library, who were emailing the commissioners to say, I support you, I don't support you, how can I donate to make sure we pay for this? But my colleague Josh Fiallo picked up on the story a few days ago, and it was in the Tampa Bay Times, and then all of a sudden it was in the Washington Post. Reuters picked up on it. And at that point, it became a lot wider than citrus. And so everything that the local community is saying is almost being drowned out a little bit by what everybody across the country is saying at this point.
Well, first of all, Zachary, I want to say I'm very proud of local news outlets. So congratulations on you and your colleague getting the story out there. Kyle, want to turn to you for a minute. I mean, this is Zachary mentioned that obviously the blowback to this New York Times subscription, the commissioner invoked President Trump. Do you have a sense of how widespread Trump-like rhetoric about the news media has become at the local level, Kyle?
Yeah, I mean, it's spread sort of far and wide. What we saw first is this spreading abroad, where you had especially authoritarian figures around the world echoing Trump's rhetoric. We saw it very sharply in Brazil with Bolsonaro. We saw it in other parts of the world where people were picking up the exact language. And then quite quickly, it started to spread around the U.S. too. This is the first case that I know of where this subscription thing had happened. And remember that this came pretty much at the same time that the White House announced that it wasn't going to be paying for the New York Times anymore, which I thought was sort of a joke, because we all know that how obsessed Trump is with the Times and with what's in it. And we know that he's going to keep reading it. But it was a kind of performative thing. But even though we haven't seen this subscription move, we have seen a lot of efforts around the country with local jurisdictions, you know, for example, being tougher or more restrictive than they have been on FOIA requests, which is, you know, journalists filing open records requests with local governments. We've seen a lot of cases where meetings that have been open are being closed or restricted. And again, local officials are using this rhetoric of fake news and lack of trust in the media, and again, echoing the Trump language to justify their decisions.
And Kyle, I mean, is our local government supposed to even be in the business of censoring information at this level, whether it's access to FOIA or whether it's really, you know, libraries, which are community centers for so many people to get access to all types of information? Is it their job to say what readers and consumers of media and American citizens can and can't get access to?
Yeah, no, of course it's not. And Tanzania, I think the point here is that the overall climate around the press is being poisoned. And I think it's a really dangerous thing. I mean, I don't think most Americans have an appreciation for how fragile these First Amendment rights that are embedded in our nation's founding are. They're fairly recent. You know, the legal tests of these cases are fairly recent. So I think a lot of people take for granted that this is just something that we have that is kind of built into the American system, and it's not. So what you're seeing at the local level, I think, is, you know, it's always been, I mean, you began this by talking about trust and how trust in the media is low. And I think, you know, trust in all institutions is low right now. Trust in Congress, trust in the church, trust in schools, trust in sports figures. And the media is part of that. But I think, and so there's always been that undercurrent. But I think Trump sort of gave it a language. And somehow, papers like the New York Times and other institutions like CNN, even NPR, they become part of people's identities. You know, it's almost like a political identity to either be part of or not part of those institutions. And some of them have benefited. I mean, the Times has had quite a substantial bump in subscriptions because of this. But there's also a downside, and I think this downside is what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, I mean, and the New York Times is the New York Times. I've, you know, full disclosure, I've worked there. There is a certain, you know, cachet and also a certain footprint that the Times has that it's able to sort of weather some of these storms. But Zachary, you're a journalist for a local news outlet, the Tampa Bay Times, which has done significant work and won Pulitzers over the years. But what's your experience been like with this growing distrust in the media as a reporter? Are you feeling that from sources that you talk to and things that you cover?
Yeah, I think it's probably experiencing it a little differently than at the national level. But, you know, it is everywhere, right? This culture is kind of in all places that we go to report. But you don't really know what to expect until you're in those places. I've done a lot of reporting in the last year in the Florida Panhandle after Hurricane Michael, and that's a staunchly conservative place that has a lot of Trump supporters. have never had any issue with being called fake news or difficulty with access to information in those places. I had no issue with it in Citrus County either, and have it on this story. But for us, I think what I see more often, and probably what's more insidious and a little bit difficult, is that people who pull the levers at the local level, people who have some power here, are using it. You know, you will have like a county commissioner or a city councilor who might use the term fake news, who might deploy that playbook. And that's where sort of the message from up top or at the national level, everything's kind of hyper-nationalized, bleeds down into local politics and into local news. And that doesn't come down to a question of media literacy, which is often what we're talking about when we're talking about trust in the news. It's manipulation, ultimately, and I think that's the thing that reporters at the national level, but especially at the local level, we're tilting against. You know, we have no interest in pushing a national agenda. We don't really cover President Trump. We're just trying to figure out what's happening here, and you know, we do feel that.
Kyle, we're heading into, and I ask this question of every guest almost, we're heading into a pretty contentious election season coming up in 2020, and a pretty contentious election. With this trend, if we can call it that, what are your concerns in terms of the access that the access to information that the public has?
I mean, it seems like the concerns sort of run the gamut. And by the way, I got to say, I thought the piece that Zachary and his colleague did was really terrific. They really laid out what was going on and why it was important. And I think, you know, I think that what's happening on the local level to the news business is sort of part of this story, because I think that what we've seen, unfortunately, is a kind of decimation of local news around the country. And I think that's certainly affecting the kind of information that people are getting, and we're basically entering an election where a lot of the campaign messaging is going to be sort of geo-targeted, right, through like closed networks like WhatsApp and others. And the only way people are going to know what these campaigns are saying is if they're on the ground. It's going to be very hard for national news organizations to sort of know what is being told to the voters in Tampa or Des Moines or Denver in a lot of cases. And the lack of a local news infrastructure, I think we're really going to feel it in this cycle. And I think it's kind of a scary thing.
And I want to get Zachary's thoughts on that. We've got about a minute left in the segment, because Zachary, you are on the ground. We know that about 1,300 communities in the United States have totally lost local news coverage. I mean, it's one thing not to have to compete with a lot of other folks, Zachary, but has your job gotten tougher? Have you guys had to really make decisions on what to cover, what not to cover, because, you know, there aren't that many of you guys left on the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. The Citrus story is an example of that. We used to, as the Times, have a bureau in Citrus with 7 or 8 reporters, and now we don't. So that's a travel story at this point. But you know, what I will say about it is that's sort of what we're talking about. This lack of trust in the media is supported by the fact that we're struggling, and so we're not in as many places as we used to be. That's not just national organizations, and so when we're not in those places, it can be harder for us to understand the people who live there, and it can be harder for the people who live there to trust and understand our intentions when we go to report in those spots.
Zachary Sampson is a staff writer for the Tampa Bay Times, and Kyle Pope is editor and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.
There are nearly 60 million people in the United States who can trace their roots back to Latin America or Spain. That's according to data from the Pew Research Center. In the United States, we've tended to call this group Hispanics or Latinos. Sometimes we refer to them by their country of origin, Cubans, Mexicans, Venezuelans, for example. Add in regional differences and the nomenclature becomes even more complicated. I am of Puerto Rican heritage, for example, but being from New York, some people might call me New Yorican. We are one of the most diverse groups in the United States today by race, ethnicity, political affiliation, and immigration status. So classifying all of us has never been simple. But one term has recently made its way into the demographic lexicon, and it's getting lots of attention.
Soy Latinx.
Comedians like Arturo Castro are also hitting the topic.
Oh, wow. You have a Latinx boyfriend, huh?
Yeah, but the proper term now is Latinx.
Yeah, that's what I said. You're Latinx.
No, people don't say Latin anymore. It's Latinx.
Yeah, because he's your ex. But when you were dating, he was...
also Latinx.
And trust me, we looked. There are dozens of podcasts that use the naming convention.
You are listening to Latinx America.
Bienvenido a Latinx Music.
Hello and welcome to Latinx on the Rise.
You're listening to Latinx Therapy.
This is Latinx Supernatural.
For more on this, I'm joined by Ed Morales. He's a lecturer at the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University and the author of Latinx, the New Force in American Politics and Culture. Ed, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the line, we have Giancarlo Sopo, a writer at The Blaze and a 2019 regional fellow at the National Review Institute. And Giancarlo recently wrote an op-ed in USA Today headlined, quote, "Progressives, Hispanics are not Latinx. Stop trying to anglicize our Spanish language." Giancarlo, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So, Giancarlo, Latinx is a popular word right now, especially on social media. When did you first hear of the term?
Yeah, so I first heard of the term in the late 2000s here in the U.S. I'm an American. And when I first encountered the term, it seemed to me like it was just trying to almost use a shorthand instead of having to write out Latinos and Latinas. People would just use the X as sort of as a substitute for that. And then I started seeing it gain some momentum, primarily among U.S. English-speaking Latinos and white progressives, and I thought that was quite problematic, so I wrote that that piece in USA Today.
That piece made quite the rounds on my Facebook and other places. Ed, tell us what the origins of the term Latinx are.
Well, I don't really have a great idea what the origins of the term are. I just remember hearing my students at Columbia begin to use it in the mid-2010s. And they used it because they wanted to create a inclusivity for people who don't identify with the binary definitions of gender.
So we're talking about Latino, Latina, and it kind of gets into a couple of areas here. There's the gender binary, and then there's also the language issue, and I want to unpack those a little bit. So people who refer to Latinx or identify as Latinx, Ed, in your experience, have been mostly young people. What have you found?
Yeah, younger people are much more prone to use it, but also members of LGBTQ community are very strong about it. I was on a panel at UPenn about a year ago, and I was on a panel with the entire panel was LGBTQ, and everyone, I was really amazed at how strong people felt about the use of the term. They began to talk about the difficulties of talking about their sexuality with their parents. It was a very emotional atmosphere in the room. So I came to appreciate how important it was for LGBTQ people.
Giancarlo, what's your issue with the word itself? I mean, is it that you don't think there's a need for a gender-inclusive identifier in Spanish?
Well, I mean, so twofold. So first off, if we're speaking English, English is not a grammatically gendered language. So if we're attempting to describe someone who is non-gender binary, they can be described in a multiple ways, right? They could still be described as being someone of Latino heritage because the Latino as an adjective doesn't have no ties to gender. They can be described as Hispanic. They can be described as Latin. And actually, polls show that most Latin Americans, they want to be described by their country of origin. So it seems to me it's a superfluous term. And if someone, you know, I'm someone who's very friendly with using people's preferred pronouns. I'll call someone whatever they want. But when you take this word to its logical conclusion, it requires dismantling the entire language. Spanish is a grammatically gendered language, as everybody knows, and that wouldn't make any sense. It makes it very difficult to communicate with immigrants who are new to this country who may not speak a lot of English. It's a completely foreign term to people like my parents, for example. People, and even a lot of millennials. I just saw a poll showing that only 3% of millennials identify with this term. So it seems to me like an unnatural imposition on a very diverse community.
Ed, you'd like to respond to that?
Well, I would say that the use of the word internet in Spanish is not being called out for destroying the language. And there's nothing about Latinx, which means that we have to degender all words and language. It's just a label that is used to signal a futurism among Latinos who want to be inclusive of people who identify in a wide spectrum of identities. And it also calls to the future of Latinos is acknowledging their mixedness and intersectionality. You know, the word Hispanic itself is not friendly to Spanish. I mean, the IC suffix doesn't exist in the Spanish language. And I don't remember an uproar about that.
Well, I remember, I mean, there is that, Ed, to your point, that sort of speaks to the idea where there's never been one word that identifies us all, right? This whole, these Latinos are, and I use the word Latinos in the United States. Are you seeing some parallels here in the contention around Latinx that the same were around when we talked about calling us all Hispanics?
Yeah, well, Latino first displaced Hispanic because it wanted to refer to an identity that wasn't entirely based in Spain and acknowledged that we have African and indigenous ancestry. So Latinx is sort of taking this next step of, and I think I'm very proud that Latinos are the first group to even have a discussion to use a word that includes LGBTQ people and people who don't identify with the gender binary.
Giancarlo, I want to talk a little bit about how this is playing out outside of the United States, because you may have a supporter here in the governing body of Spanish, if you will, the Real Academia Español over in Spain. They have rejected so far the use of X as a gender-neutral alternative, and their director said recently, quote, the problem is we're confusing grammar with machismo. Mm-hmm. So the Spanish Real Academia seems to support you, but this conversation is happening beyond the U.S., isn't it?
Yeah, so there's some tendencies in Latin America. We're seeing in countries like Chile and Argentina and Mexico to use the suffix of E instead of O as an A to try to make words gender neutral. What linguists whom I've consulted, and I spoke with James Harris of MIT on this, what they've told me actually is that Americans are confusing grammatical gender with biological sex and then imposing on top of that our 2019 progressive sensibilities. Grammar and biological sex are two totally different things. The nature of words in Spanish, depending on whether they have an A or an O, it's a lexical construct. It has nothing to do with biological sex. When it deals with humans, it's a little different. And I agree that there are some, that when we're talking to people who are non-binary, it's tricky, but that's not an issue in English. English, you have it's a gender neutral language. You don't have any kind of grammatical gendered words the same way that you have in Spanish. And there are a ton of words that can be used to describe people who are non-binary. And I don't think it's, I mean, if you want to call somebody who's non-binary Latinx, I think that's fine. You shouldn't then take that term and impose that on all Latinos who polls show 98% of them don't identify with.
Let's break that down a little bit, because I think there's a lot there. I mean, one of the things that we are in a moment right now where we are, as a society, I think, challenging a lot of these social constructs, whether they come in language, whether we're talking about gender, whether we're talking about a lot of different things. So this seems to be an appropriate moment to do that. When I talk to a lot of people, a lot of Latinos, and again, I use the term Latinos, they feel okay with inclusive language. If you want to be Latinx, be Latinx, but they're a little bit more uncomfortable with the sort of blanket use of the term that's showing up a lot in media. What do you say to that?
I don't think that anyone is trying to impose the word on anyone. I think the use of gendered words having absolutely nothing to do, I think, is a very abstract idea that doesn't really operate in real human life. And then I would also add that certain terms are not immediately accepted. You know, African-American was not accepted immediately. A lot of people had a hard time letting go of Negro. Stanley Crouch was still talking about Negro when I wrote at the Village Voice, you know, in the 80s and 90s. The other thing I would say, too, about the use of Latino as a universal word is that I understand that it doesn't appeal to everyone. But if you withdraw from the idea of Latino, you're giving up an enormous amount of political power and allowing other people to use the term to your disadvantage.
What about taking it to Giancarlo's point? I mean, Giancarlo, is your concern here that the use of this personal identifier, for particularly for non-binary Latinos or Latines, if you will, is going to then have a conclusion where we will have to restructure the entire Spanish language? Or, I mean, is that a realistic way to look at it?
Yeah, so some people are pushing for something like that in Latin America. And even when we're speaking in plural, the word Latinos, right, in neither English or Spanish, it's a gender inclusive term. So everyone's already included in these terms. So a lot of this is actually just has an undercurrent of fallacies and conflation of grammatical gender with biological sex, which they're two separate things.
A lot of people would push back on that and say, no, I mean, these identifiers are really important. And the gendering of this language is important. And how we identify is important. Ed, would you want to respond to that?
I remember the first time I heard gay Latino men use a feminine suffix in describing what they're how they're feeling. For instance, saying "I'm cansada," and it was a real signal to me about what their identity was. And I think it was really important they were allowed to do that.
So, Giancarlo, I want to get your thoughts on any of these umbrella terms that we're using, right? I mean, the Hispanic has been contentious, Latino has been contentious. We're talking about a very diverse group of people. Is there a danger to using any of those terms? And to Ed's point, you know, do you dilute your political power if you stay away from some of these words?
Yeah, so I think part of what the Latinx term is doing is that I think it's putting a lot of strain on these umbrella identifiers. I do think, though, that for a large segment of the population that is as diverse as Latinos are, if you really think about it, I don't think it makes a lot of sense to put, you know, people as diverse as, you know, Cuban Americans, Argentines, and Mexican Americans all in the same ethnic bucket, the same way that no demographer would ever put a Texan and a Londoner in the same bucket merely because they both speak English. So I think there are significant cultural differences among different Latino communities. And these umbrella terms are really being tested now because a lot of people, they just prefer to be called by their national origin.
Ed, do you think we should abandon this issue of Latino, Latinx, Latine, Hispanic? And should we really begin to focus on national identity or ethnic origin or some other term? I'm not sure whether any of these are working for us as a whole.
The collective identity of Latin American descendants in the U.S. has a long history, and it's not like we can just wipe it out by deciding not to do that. And there's a lot of political organizing around that kind of identity. There's certainly a lot of diversity. You know, my argument is that Latino identity is about acknowledging diversity as almost a definition. I know it's a kind of a contradiction, but it's a way for people to identify with each other and work together. You know, one of the main challenges for Latinos today is to both reinforce their individual home country identities and at the same time find ways to make a common ground with Latinos.
Is there a rule? You know, is it okay, I should say, because I'm tweeting now and I say Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine. I mean, it's gotten much longer, you know, in my tweets. Can I just go back to Latino?
I use Latino a lot. I use Latino slash A. You know, Residente tweeted the other day about Latinas and saying that to represent all Latinos. You know, that's another thing that you can do. I don't really think that there should be rules. And I think the idea that there is an imposition of rules is something that comes from people who are criticizing progressive people. So all of these language games that are being played, I don't really think have a lot to do with the reality of the way that people are learning about their identities and expressing them.
Ed Morales is the author of Latinx, The New Force in American Politics and Culture. And Giancarlo Sopo is a writer at The Blaze and a 2019 regional fellow at the National Review Institute. Thanks to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Rachel from Louisville. My comment on the word Latinx is it feels clumsy in the mouth, like an awkward attempt to make a word gender neutral when the language really wasn't set up for that. However, that same awkwardness reminds the speaker and the listeners of why the change was made, why it was important and necessary, and of all the people the word represents who were previously invisible.
Hello, my name is Raphael, and I live in South El Monte, California. I have heard of the term Latinx. I do not identify with it at all. I reject it completely. I am Mexican-American, first generation born in California. I identify as Mexican or Mexican-American, not Latino. Latinos are Anglo-Europeans from Italy, not Hispanic. Hispanics are Anglo-European from Spain.
Hi, this is Lindsay from South Plainfield, New Jersey. I try to stay educated and use preferred pronouns and cultural identity markers whenever I can. I do a lot of introductions as part of my job, and when in doubt, I always ask for preferences from folks. Of course, it's not always possible when referring to a group of people, and this new term has me completely flummoxed. Generally, I've avoided using it because I don't want to offend anyone, and I don't actually completely understand it myself.
Thanks, as always, for weighing in. You can keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Sigue llamándonos al 877-869-8253. And if you don't already, make sure to follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. You can find me at Tanzina Vega. And of course, we're on Facebook and Instagram. Our team includes producers Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Andres O'Hara, Jivika Varma, Rob Gunther, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Lydia McMullen-Laird, Tammy Fogg-Benle, and Joseph Gedeon. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Polly Arungu and Dina Saeed Ahmed are our digital editors. Our tech team is Vince Fairchild and Jay Cowett. David Gable is our slice of cake and administrative assistant. And Lita Hallowell is our intern. Dieter Debke is our executive producer. Thank you so much for listening to us this week and every week. I hope you'll join me again next time. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.